Hello, Joel here. I've got a new book out. It's called Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And it's about how comedy works and why it matters. Why human beings tell jokes, and then what that tells us about being human beings. So if you're a human being and you enjoy laughing and then want to know what the hell's going on with that, it's probably a pretty good book to read. It's called Be Funny or Die. It's in shops. You can buy it.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to Rule of Three, a podcast about comedy. I'm Joel Morris.
I'm Jason Hazley.
And as usual, we're joined by someone who makes comedy to talk about something funny that they love. By taking it apart, maybe we'll learn something about how comedy works, or we'll just quote bits from it and giggle until we're finished. Both approaches are valid. Our special guest today is Aisling B.
Hello.
Hello.
I love that phrase, giggle until you finish. It's quite how I like to make love. Don't you worry about me, love. I'll just giggle until you finish. Yes, welcome to me. Thank you for having me. English great.
Oh, thanks for coming in. Thank you very, very, very much.
We were just talking about being on stupid deadlines because we're all being busy and things, and saying that there's a version of me that I think exists who is someone who's got this, who's not scrambling about desperately. Because obviously, you come into these podcasts and you sit down and say, how are you doing? You talk about work and things. And I said, we're in the middle of about 14 cascading domino deadlines. And this morning I woke up and went, oh, why can't I be that guy? The guy who isn't just slamming every idea I've got onto a piece of paper as quickly as possible and hoping to get away with it.
But that's your process. That is your process that you've always done. And it's about getting to the point where you accept that that's your process. I was almost saying to you earlier on, I read this book about, because I think we all dream of, especially as a creative, of being the Roald Dahl who goes into his shed and works from 9 to 6, has a break for coffee, and then goes and has his dinner and has a life after that in the evenings. That's what a professional adult looks like, because that's what we know a real job looks like, and we want to make this a real job because we're getting paid. So the idea that we have notebooks that are waterproof stuck in our shower in case we get an idea in the shower. Yeah. And then there's like, you get a back of a receipt and you're like, that's where I'll write my opus, on the back of this receipt with a pencil that will not be waterproof. And then there's all the, and we're like that, but that is a creative process. You get ideas from little places, and this, the reason it drives us all mentally unwell is because there's no 6 p.m. to a creative brain. There's no time when you switch off. I often have my greatest ideas just before I go to bed, and sometimes I write them down and sometimes I don't, and then I'll wake up the next morning going, well, thank God I wrote that down, and they'll say like, dog, no, really? And I'm like, no, what did it mean? But in this book I was reading about how, like, that our idea is that that's the serious business person who deserves to be paid, and the other version is cheating or getting away with it. And they were like, we have entered into a society that doesn't applaud winging it, because we call it winging it, that doesn't applaud thinking on your feet as a skill, that you're like, oh, that's cheating, or that's like bullshit. What liars do, that's what bullshitters do, they think on their feet and get away with something, rather than that being something like in The Apprentice, they always applaud the people who can think on their feet. Alan Sugar never fires, you thought on your feet and it was great, and that's what I need in the business. And that's kind of what you don't get to, if you could maybe relax into that a little bit. Like for me, I'm writing my TV show at the moment, and I've put all of these 4 days a week, 6 hours a day to write the show. And my friend Sarah Pascoe, a great comedian, was like, why don't you just say, try and do half an hour to an hour a day and limit how much you're actually going to do, and that be the homeworky bit. And then the rest of the time, walk around, go and see friends. Yeah. If you come up with an idea or a line that'll be funny, jot it down in your notepad. But don't like take that pressure off as if you're going to suddenly become a new type of person. Like, what age are you at this stage, Joel? You're one of the most successful comedy writers in the UK. It's not going to happen.
It happened the week I realised
that. I realised there wasn't a single job
I'd done from my exams at school to now that I hadn't done in a scramble at the last minute without proper preparation. And I'd always got away with it, and it's fine. I did it the weekend. I got
You got away with it.
Yeah.
You're doing more than getting away with it.
It's doing well.
You've written on the biggest TV shows
where my
in
brain
Britain
works
and
well.
Your child is not hungry.
Yeah, I did this at the weekend. We went away. The way at the weekend, my wife insisted and had booked that we go away at the weekend with a hammering deadline on. Mm-hmm. And I got her to agree before we went away. I said, look, we've got this hammering deadline. If I have to sit down for 2 hours and write, is it okay if I do that? I'll take my laptop to the back room and keep out of the way, and you can, we're on a beautiful peninsula somewhere with a beautiful horizon and seabirds and things. I said, if I have to go away and write, that'll be my Roald Dahl. I'll go away and write.
Yeah.
I went and did it. I sat and I wrote dog shit. I wrote nothing. And I said, all it meant is that for 2 hours, I'd not been with my family. It was awful.
Yeah.
And she said, just go out for a walk. And I went out for a walk, and within 10 minutes, I'd solved every single problem that I couldn't solve in my fake Roald Dahl seat, because my brain doesn't work that way. And I was refusing to accept that actually what I needed to do was to stop panicking and just bullshit. And bullshit is what I get paid for.
I read another article, if you can imagine. I'm a white woman who reads articles and watches documentaries. Imagine. So if you need any information, I'm pretty much a trained doctor now because of my Netflix algorithms. I was reading this thing about like why we're afraid, particularly women, but I think this falls into a lot of creators as well, to back ourselves or back our creative process, and why we procrastinate a lot of the time is because there's a fear of, especially I would count both of you two as very humble people, given all that you've achieved.
I'm the best.
And oh my God, you're so the best. Only to second to me. And there's something about, imagine if you did it. Imagine you succeeded. And that fear of, that falls into the same place as knowing success kind of might fall into the same place as discomfort or something not nice and unknown. And that's scary. And the body picks up on that as a fear or something to avoid.
It's new. It's an unfamiliar
feeling.
It's new
and unfamiliar, and that's exactly the thing the body always avoids. It avoids it with exercise when we're trying to stretch ourselves or run farther, or when we're in a relationship and we're like, oh, this is new. I don't know what's going to happen
or
here.
Rats,
so maybe I'll back
rats
out.
Sniff around a bin and they won't.
Do you know?
Eat
and you should befriend those rats. Is the point of this article?
They
befriend
you.
The rats. They could be the only thing that keeps you safe in the apocalypse, ladies and gentlemen. befriend the rats.
They've got the email addresses of the cockroaches
and the cockroaches.
The fucking jellyfish. I started reading a book called Stung about jellyfish, which basically explained that jellyfish are like super cockroaches.
Yeah.
They are immune to everything. They're immune to radioactivity.
But not criticism.
Electricity. Not criticism,
they
of course.
Very thin skins.
No, but I got about 100 pages into this book, and I had to put it down because it was so frightening. Because they've got no brain but 400 stomachs or something. They're just the most terrifying creatures. Sorry to go off on a jellyfish tangent.
It's not a tangent, though, because at some point, I know I'll be watching a Charlie Brooker thing or something that you guys write on, and there'll be a jellyfish bit in it. And that's why you have to allow all those moments where you just read 100 pages of a jellyfish book, because at some point it'll come in.
Well, on a work point, do you do that? Do you take time off and just fill the tanks? Just read, walk, absorb stuff?
Walking and stuff I do. I'm very bad at taking holidays. Oh, just to finish up my point, though, before about procrastination and the fear of the unknown, is that sometimes we self-sabotage by like writing nothing or walking around or whatever it is, because we're afraid that what if we sat down and did it? Oh God, we might succeed.
Yeah. Oh God.
So part of it is our creative process, but then the other part is actually afraid that we'd be the best. We do our best work and either A, get rejected and go, oh, it's still not good enough, or B, that we would actually succeed and it would do really well.
Carrie Ed Lloyd says something brilliant about that, why she likes improv rather than writing. She said that because she's making up on the hoof, she goes, well, how good do you expect it to be? And I think there's, I've never even thought about this, something in doing something in a hurry, in a rush, at the last minute.
Takes the pressure off you.
You go, weirdly, okay, well, it doesn't have to be the best thing. All it has to be is a thing. And today, we're at the moment, both of us are in a writing jag where as long as we fill the pages, this job will not fail.
I have that about certain panel shows and live TV. I get less stressed about live TV, even though technically one slip of the tongue and I could ruin everything. Because I'm like, oh, well, it's live. What are we going to do if it goes badly? And the same with shows like QI, where it's all improv. I just go on feeling completely calm because I'm like, we have no idea what's going to happen here. With other panel shows where, you know, we know in advance roughly the news, roughly the topics that are going to come up, and you have to work on your jokes and get your gags in, but you're not really sure if someone else is going to have the same angle on you. Has someone already tweeted this? Blah, 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 blah.
Pressure's up.
When does this go out? Will the news have changed by then? What will Trump have done by then? Will Brexit have changed? No is the answer to that. Oh, never. That puts more pressure on because, oh, you had the time to make this perfect and it hasn't. It won't be.
You thought that was good enough.
Yeah, you thought that was good enough, and then all the anomalies on the night. Are the audience in good form? Are you in good form with the person who's beside you? Or is someone going to jump over you and, you know, shout over you before you get to the end of your punchline? A lot of the time, yes. that in those situations, you're like, you put more pressure on yourself, even though it's kind of the exact same situation. That really, to sell anything like garlic bread, all you have to do is really believe you're funny.
Yeah.
And the difference between saying something when you believe you're funny and the pressure's off and you can feel like a kid again in this job is the difference. That's where the magic is, and that makes the difference. But you can't
clicking the button to say that you're now doing this, the taxi meter's running, someone's paying you for this.
Yeah.
I remember finding that the first thing that I found frightening, turning from being someone who'd done stuff for sort of school magazines and things and someone who's being paid, was the absolute rabbit in headlights freezing of the first day turning up. Before, I think I did some work before we worked together. I turned up on my own for some sessions and sat down and went, oh my God, they're going to pay me for this. You've seen some sample work and you're paying me for this. And now I've got to be not only as good as I think I am, but as good as you hope I am. And you just freeze. You totally freeze. Because actually the expectation is that this has also got to be good. And you forget that actually the reason you're here is because you're funny or
one
you're
time
good at this.
And this is a very showbiz story. One time I was booked for this panel show and I was filming a job in Bristol, and I was only booked the night before, and they were like, we really need you to fill in. Is there any way you'll do it? The fee was really good. And I was like, oh God, but I'll be wrecked by the time I got down there. And also,
You mean tired rather than drunk?
Tired rather than drunk. Yeah, I was actually genuinely tired. Actually, in fairness to me, I was actually tired. But I was really tired. We'd been filming. Oh, yeah. The night before, we'd started filming kind of from 6 o'clock. And I decided to go to Leicester to do a preview of my Edinburgh show, then come back that night to make sure I was on set on the Friday at 6 a.m. A really clever idea for all of my head and my mental health. And then that night on the way back on the train, they sent me through what we'd be talking about. And it was all sport and I had no idea about sport, but they also said that they were like, look, don't worry, Aisling, to make sure you make it in time, we'll send a helicopter for you to get you from Bristol down to Elstree Studios on the Friday.
Wow.
And again, I wasn't used to, like, in any way being, I don't feel like a celebrity or someone who would be of that much value, and that's my own self-esteem issues. So I was like, I need to be beyond fantastic, despite all the things that normally get in the way, no matter what way you get there. But for me, for someone to send a helicopter for me, like, I'm not going to get there and go, I've cured it. Cancer, that is. I was worth it. And so I landed in, was knackered because I'd had 2 days of nonstop. I'd put so much pressure on myself. I knew roughly the questions that were going to be asked to me. And there was another person on the show with a similar name to me. And the hosts asked my questions. And I was so tired and just didn't feel funny anymore. I felt sadness. and again, when you're on a panel show and you're a girl, they take an hour doing your makeup instead of 5 minutes to give you a dust and a wash.
Oh,
and so I rather than being able to work on my jokes and everyone else was getting together and chatting and creating banter, I was inside having someone do my mascara. But like, you don't want to go and tell you without your mascara on. But I was like, oh God, I just want to, can you hurry this up? And then that's insulting to the makeup artist if you go, hurry it up and just do the best you can.
Because they're showing their work
off
as well.
They're doing their work, and they want to be safe and have, you know, pride in their work. I was the only girl on the show as well, so she was really giving it socks. And she's like, do you want fake eyelashes? I was like, no time! And then I went on the show and just, again, the host asked my questions to another person who wasn't a comedian, so they didn't care. And I was like, oh my God, if he comes to me with anything, I have no solid jokes. I haven't thought it through. I have no jokes. And came to me, I did the lowest common denominator, like vag related jokes that I wasn't proud of at all. And I was like, oh God. And I was like, they've paid for a helicopter to get me here. And everyone
below
knew.
Below the belt material.
Honestly, like, it was the first, I'd never been in a helicopter. I saw England through my glass-footed helicopter window.
It's fucking weird, isn't it? Looking through those
so
foot windows
weird.
In a helicopter.
The foot windows, I just couldn't. And I felt so...
Oh, it's helicopter club over there.
Do you
People
remember?
Have been in helicopters.
Yeah. Have you not been in a helicopter?
No, babe, you should do it. You should really do
it. I'll go
it.
Now.
Do you remember back years ago, there was a clip that went viral of the man who'd come in for a random meeting and they just put him on BBC News to talk about Brexit.
Yeah. Guy Gomer, yes.
Yes, and he just winged it. And I felt as I was landing into this helicopter, and everyone knew, like Noel Fielding knew it, I'd come in a helicopter. Everyone knew I'd come in a helicopter. So I must be bloody worth it. And I just tanked and died on the show. I couldn't get, it was just, I didn't feel funny in my gut at all. And like, it was fine, it edited fine, but the panel shows actually last for 3 or 4 hours, not just like the 25 minutes you see. They're big records. And even though I knew it edited fine, I was like, to not be funny for 4 hours after a very long day and to know that you came in a helicopter. And I was still like one of the least famous people on the show. Like, I was so not worth a helicopter in my head. I put so much pressure on myself in that situation rather than going, haha, enjoy the helicopter. I'm going to get there. What'll be, will be.
What we're talking about today and what you brought in, I think, is a very, very good example of something where two untried writers and two untried performers had a light shone on them and said, OK, do the best you can do. Just be as funny as you were down the pub. And seemed effortlessly to be able to produce one of the funniest sitcoms that's ever been made. And no one knew what they were doing, and everyone should have felt that pressure. But you get the feeling watching this program that no one's feeling any pressure at all.
Father Ted is pure silliness. Father Ted, but it says a lot, actually, but only because those are in the background. Silliness is the name of the game.
Yes. Got
silly,
one aim,
how silly can you be? Certain things about it had a massive effect on me. A lot of people say in Ireland it was a show about funny priests. In the UK it's a show about funny Irish people.
Right.
Because the intricacies of the joke are, they're deeper when you're actually in Ireland and you grow up in a country that is, I have a joke in my stand-up at the moment where like Ireland is 86% Catholic and the other 14% are ghosts. Like there's nothing else in Ireland. And so that is every house, every place. And for people maybe in Britain watching it, it's every Irish person they've ever met are quite like that. I remember the first time I saw Father Ted. So growing up, we only had two stations and we didn't have Channel 4.
They were both just Mulligan and O'Hare on a loop.
Yeah, Mulligan and O'Hare on a loop. And then the Angelus, which it genuinely is on at 6 p.m. still to this day.
Really?
Every single day at 6 p.m.
This is prayers,
modern Ireland, yeah. A minute of silence where they go bong, bong, bong for a minute. And the whole point is that we all stop and go, oh, Jesus.
I went around the Ring of Kerry when I was in my 20s and with my brothers, and we watched Irish television. We didn't realise quite how much Irish television is different than British
it's
television.
It's very, very different,
and
isn't it?
We watched it, and it was constantly people who appeared to be Vic and Bob dressed as folk singers and religious programmes. And on the last day, we saw an advert on one of the stations for the Best of Supertramp. And all of us, it was like we'd seen Godwin. there's a world outside. And we went back, and I'm coming back and buying the best of Supertramp, yeah. listening to it outside Ireland, and it was just boring middle-of-the-road music. But yeah. in Ireland, it was like punk.
Oh, yeah. It lost their bloody minds. Also, there's a sort of quality to Ireland, because there is only 5 million people, that we move as one. And when everyone's brought up with the same religion and the same cultural reference, like now everyone's got loads of podcasts and people watch things, and like you can watch your iPad with your mom and dad, blah blah blah.
God, it changed everything. Yeah,
because there was only two stations, so under a certain age everyone has the exact same cultural memories of the moment we heard on the news that X, Y and Z had, whether we all know about we know the exact clips of the Birmingham 6 being released at what, like there's a certain point up until the last 10 years or maybe 20 years where you'd one or two TVs in a house, the certain things are on at certain times. If you missed it, you couldn't record it. And Ireland has a quality about it, which is a small town rather than a country. So you're never going to be allowed suddenly make something crazy. So you would have, well, what's not crazy? It's like Foster and Allen singing like, her hair, they shone like diamonds. You know, that won't offend anyone, but everyone at the same time.
Very good vibrato. Well,
thank you very much. Yeah, I'm brought up to naturally sing very sadly at the drop of a hat. But I remember my mother was bringing a school tour that she was like a substitute teacher, and she was taking a school tour to Paris in France, and my aunt came with her to mind myself and my sister because we had no one at home to look after us. So we went to Paris, France, and we stayed with this really posh woman, French woman, who my mother knew from being a pen pal when they were teenagers. So these really posh French people came over to like basically slum it with Irish people on farms when they were young, and mommy kind of kept their addresses, and so we stayed in Paris with them, and they had a really posh, like they, so here's how posh they were. They had a real Monet in their house.
What?
And they lived near the Arc de Triomphe in Paris. Yeah, they were proper like countesses or something like that. We had no idea. I remember one time this woman gave me olive bread and I thought it was chocolate and I spat it in her face, and like this is a woman who was in line to the French throne at one point. I was like, this is bullshit, I'm 11 and I hate this, and we didn't understand status. And also there was this, I always remember mommy was like, no, my aunt said to me, you know that's a Louis the XIV's chair in there, and we didn't know what that meant. And I remember, I probably shouldn't say this, I doubt that the contest listens to podcasts, no offence lads, I remember sitting on the chair and it cracking. And
whoa.
Yeah, that's the first time I've remembered that thing, and I'm really sorry. Je suis désolé.
It's now two Louis XIV's chairs. Yeah, yeah.
It's a stool and some sticks from Louis XIV's era.
De petits chaises.
But I remember she had all the stations. So she had, that like 100 stations or something like that, because they were so posh. And I kind of crept upstairs while they were all asleep, and this thing came
on.
How
old were you?
I'd say I was like 11 or 12, because I was still in primary school. I know, because we weren't allowed to stay with friends, so we had to go with mommy.
Yes,
while she
was,
it was
like
the Easter holiday, something like that. And it must have been, now I know, it would have been Channel 4 that we struck into, but I'd never seen Channel 4 before. And these Irish accents came on. So at first I was like, Irish people on TV in France? Like, what the hell is this? Yeah. And it was the episode of like Bishop Casey getting the stone put up his arse. And I couldn't believe that I, in some way, was on telly. And not just me, but priests.
So what are we doing today, Ted? Confessions and mass and things like that, I suppose.
Yes, stupid. Things like that.
It's great being a priest, isn't it, Ted?
Like, we were brought up, my aunt was a nun, but priests were the most important people in the town. All my education system up until the 18 was religious orders, as was most people in the country. And I couldn't believe people were making fun, because it wasn't allowed on Irish TV stations for probably another 5 years. Again, until something became successful in England.
Not until the millennium, probably, then.
Yeah, so near enough. Yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So until, because I only remember it coming on to Irish TV when I was more of a teenager. And again, it was sort of banned for being sort of blasphemous. And I remember thinking, I ran down to mommy, like, mommy, will you come upstairs? She's like, go away, I'm tired. And I was like, you don't understand. They're making fun of priests on the telly. And I think she thought I had a fever or something like that. Because I just kind of ran downstairs from the telly near the Monet and was like, you don't understand. Priests are on telly and Ireland is in France and you don't understand.
I think so it must have been like radically transgressive.
It was, I couldn't believe, like, because also, I didn't know whether I was dreaming or the telly had magically decided to be there for me. There was no one else in the room.
It was like he was talking straight to you.
Yeah, and it was making me laugh, and it was like real jokes, because the only, I hadn't really seen comedy before, but all I knew is I loved making people laugh, and I did. I've since the word dot, I made my family laugh. I wrote all the school plays from the age of five. I like made plays in the and so this idea of all of a sudden there was a version of me. And then as I got older and watched it as a teenager, not only was I there, but the amount of female idiots in it was really important, because you have Mrs. Doyle. I remember seeing Mrs. Doyle, Pauline McGlynn, who's now a pal, on like a chat show, like the, the Irish chat show, and I could not believe how well she looked. I couldn't believe that she was a beautiful woman, probably at the time in her 40s.
Isn't she? Yep.
But I was like, oh, she's... I didn't understand it was a mole in makeup. Like,
she was
in my
clown.
Head.
She'd clowned
up. It was totally clowned
she's
up and
dressed
stupid
like Terry
and physical
Jones in
and
drag.
Ugly.
She's dressed like a Python pepper pot.
Absolutely. She's, but she's doing it. There's no drag involved. It's not like, oh, wouldn't it be funnier if we knew this actor had a penis? This
it's not
woman
Mrs. Brown.
Was... She was falling over and getting smacked in the head.
You won't have a cup.
No, thanks, Mrs. Doyle. Honestly, I won't have a cup.
Are you sure now it's hot?
No, I'm not in the mood, thanks.
All right, so. I go on, would you not have a drop?
No, thanks anyway,
just
Mrs. Doyle.
Cup.
I'm fine. No, really.
I'll tell you what, Father. I'll pour
seriously.
A cup for you anyway. And you can have it if you want. No. And what do you say to a cup?
Take off, cup!
He loves his cup of tea.
Take off!
And on a similar note, the two Johnny and Mary, who are
sounds
really dark, but technically that could be domestic abuse. But it's even domestic abuse where they're both kicking the shit out of each other.
Fat, smelly cow.
You have a face like a pair of tits.
Well, at least that's one pair between us.
Hello, Mary.
Ah, hello, Father.
Hello, John.
Pack
of
Father.
No, thanks.
And it's so equality. Like, it's so he'll stab her and she'll stab him.
Yeah.
That it's so lovely. Like, I love in comedy when a woman can get knocked out and come back with a punch and the man gets knocked out. And you're both getting to be stupid and ugly and angry. Because if you're allowing magic for one character, why don't you allow magic? Like, one of my least favourite things is on a panel show that's happened to me recently. The host sneered the first introduced the first person and sneered them, and then introduced the second, another male comedian, and sneered them, and then came to me, and rather than making a joke about me, made a joke which was like, and there's Aisling, but of course she's not as bad as, and went back to the first male comedian.
Oh my God.
And I was like, I am a professional and I can handle it, but you didn't need to go. I understand where you're coming from to go easy on me, but fucking go for me and let me come back at you. I'm grand.
Yeah.
And I remembered that with Father Ted as well. The women were smacked over the head with a frying pan or locked in a cupboard, and she'll go back and stab her husband in the morning, and we're never worried about her and we're never worried about him.
Everyone's a clown.
Because the two of them, everyone's a clown and an idiot. And I loved that. And even like there was a Sinead O'Connor character who came
in. Claire Grogan, isn't it?
Playing? Yes.
Yeah, she's brilliant.
And she got to be a cartoon. She wasn't like a straight woman that Dougal just got to be around. She got to be a piss take of the Sinead O'Connor coming in to like the place and being like, oh, that's mad, you do that. And she got to be stupid as well. And same with the nuns. And Graham often talks about sometimes he finds it hard. I know Graham well enough now. I think now he thinks he finds it hard to write female characters, but he actually doesn't. Just write as many idiots as possible.
In fact, what you're saying there is what we said at the beginning. He's, I think, knowing Graham, sometimes he puts pressure on himself because he's aware that he's working.
Like what we were talking about earlier,
he's
with
working,
pressure. He
he's working
to me
in
before.
A form where he knows that there's Seinfeld and there's these great examples of it all. And I get the feeling, talking to Graham about his work, that he sometimes feels there's this pressure because he's a good writer. He's got this astonishing legacy of work that he's trying to live up to that. The great thing, I watched the first couple of Ted's last night just to remind myself of them. They're effortlessly free of a sense of anyone watching it.
Yeah.
You want to just let
it
go.
It's also, I suppose, maybe if you write the idiots you know. So at the moment, like, as in if you know an old idiot cleaner who cleans a priest's house, or if you know some stupid nuns, like we all know the nuns who are like, oh, Father's here. I'll never be as good as a man priest. No way. Like, I often think about that. I was like, no wonder we've all got this glass ceiling in Ireland as women, because we look at these women who are fearful and awful and great, but also very scary. And everyone's like, oh, the nuns used to scare the shit out of us. And we're like, yeah, they're ballsy hard asses. They're like Sheryl Sandberg on coke. And yet then a priest comes in, they're like, oh,
Father, I could never be a priest. No, not me.
They're brides of Christ. They're not Christ.
Brides of Christ, not Christ. And I'm like, they are beyond Christ. They are like well above Christ. And so, but they're in their head, they're like, well, no, it'd be stupid for me to think I could do that. And like, why? Why is it like at some point there's a limit that we're never questioning, that we can only go so far, even with the nuns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
At the moment, for example, I'm with my TV show that I'm writing, there's this one character that is essential, and I don't want to write him as what I would describe the boring girlfriend character, which I often get have to audition for and then jazz up with an accent or something like that.
Is it called that on the IMDb entry? Boring girlfriend.
Yeah, boring girlfriend character. Like, oh, I know, no, it's not like you're the straight man, because you're great, just like funny in that next door kind of way. But the thing about it is, because you're so funny, you'll bring a lot to it that's not there on the page. Well, just fucking put something on the page, please. Yeah. But like, no, because you don't have to. Yeah, but also it's like that sort of thing of going, no, because the thing is, he's so crazy, we need someone to bring him back down. No, honestly, you can have two crazy people in a scene.
Yeah,
I'm not going to pull focus.
If there's something, someone said this to me once ages ago, we first started out, said the worst role in comedy is, oh, Mr. Spencer.
Yeah.
And the point is, you should always check your script for, is anyone doing that?
Yeah.
Because actually, it works for a sketch. You can just about get away with it if there's a weird Marty Feldman-y guy who turns up in a shop and
so
is crazy.
Boring.
But if you're going to try and make that one of the lead characters in your sitcom, just double check someone isn't just going, but you've put it on the, oh my god, Paul Putner who told me this actually. Paul Putner said, always watch out, because Paul used to get cast as, oh, Mr. Spencer, and he ended up doing it as a joke sometimes in Little Britain sketches. He'd go, but you can't come in here and say that.
Yeah,
no, that all you're doing is explaining the premise of the sketch.
Yeah,
and if you put that person in
and
a sitcom,
and you don't give them any personality
die.
traits, no. And sometimes their exterior, like, oh, she's a bit overweight, or she you know, she comes in with, maybe she has a colourful blouse on,
so she has a bit of a character. And you're like, don't give her a blouse, give her a line. The blouse should be able to be bland so that everything inside her is mad.
I think there might be, in Father Ted, I think there might be some context that we, the English, mm-hmm. missed when we watched it that the Irish would have got. Because things tons of it, I imagine. Because like just learning that you had prayers at 6 o'clock every night on TV. Yeah. That feels like you're talking about something that happened 400 years ago.
Yeah,
because it's funny in Father Ted that he can become a TV star as a priest. Because that's a joke if you're British.
Yeah.
That's a joke. But if you're Irish, you're like, I can imagine actually him getting through.
Right.
And I think, but I remember the, I don't remember when it came out, but I know, you know, the Two Ronnies sketch of like, you're up here because I'm upper class.
We don't have a class system
in Ireland. So that idea that you in Ireland people just like become wealthy through some dodgy dealings or something like that, but there's no inherent class system. There's a system of like the difference between the townies and the countryside farmers a little bit, but that class system that you guys have here, that joke, again, you guys understand it so like, oh, that's because my dad was working class and he would have been in the war and only gone like so far up or whatever. Or my granddad would have fought there and he would have been only been able to be at a certain level in the army because obviously it was the posh boys from Eton.
And the thing that we both watched a documentary called Small Far Away Channel 4 documentary about Father Ted. And one of the things that Ardlo Hanlon in there says that John and Mary are a joke about how people behave in front of priests, like their marriage is absolutely fine, whereas
because
actually
remember,
in the background they're kneeing each other in the balls
when
Father and trying to kill each other.
When Father Ted came out, there was no legal divorce in Ireland.
Oh, God.
And still you have to be separated for 2 years.
When did condoms become legal in Ireland?
Oh, something
1990
like,
or something.
You could only get until without a prescription you had to be married until something like 1993. So if you were gay, you couldn't get condoms. Homosexuality was only decriminalised in 1992, I think. I'm probably going to get corrections on this, but it'll only be off by a year. Suicide was only decriminalised in 1989. Divorce only came in 1995. So those things, again, they do come with something else. It's not just like keeping up with the Joneses.
Yeah.
It's that there's no such thing as a failed marriage because you can't get out of it.
Well, weirdly, one of the things
one of you has to die.
One of the things that works, I think, with Father Ted, and it works, is that it feels like, I mean, I know that their joke at the beginning, they thought they were taking the piss out of sitcom. They thought it would be a parody or a pastiche sitcom. And oddly, what Jeffrey Perkins, the producer, pointed out is actually it's a beautiful sitcom and you will love the characters. They wanted to do, it was originally going to be a mock doc.
Mm.
And they eventually were persuaded by Jeffrey Perkins to turn it into a sitcom with proper characters that you liked.
Mm.
One of the things that works brilliantly with Father Ted and with most of Graham and Arthur stuff is it feels old-fashioned or a celebration of old-fashioned. And certainly if you were English...
Of music hall, of playing to the... There's an audience
and,
there in a
and
wink.
Oddly, I think if you're English, you're looking at it and going, oh, they appear to have the values of the sitcoms I watched when I was growing up. And it's because Ireland was set 40 or 50 years earlier.
Yes,
that there was something at stake with holding a marriage together with respect for the vicars come round. Mm. It has all those lovely values of Terry and June.
Yeah.
Which would be impossible to make in the UK in 1995.
And it reads true in Ireland because religion has, I mean, look at the recent referendum on abortion.
Yeah.
That I couldn't believe when I went home, the posters you saw were kind of apocalyptic and I don't think anyone in England could imagine some of the posters and Jesus is watching and all this kind of stuff. Father Ted deciding, like these two young lads going over to England to Channel 4 and making a show that basically was a big up yours in certain ways to the Catholic Church was unbelievable. Like that was a bit like you over here were going, it's unbelievably funny. Over at home, we were like, this is unbelievable. Someone's managed to do this. Like they're taking the piss out of us. And also,
it's two sitcoms at once. One is a very traditional sort of, if you're English, it feels like a traditional pastiche of, it's got that Terry and June, oh no, the boss is coming over, it's a bishop, whatever like that. Oh no, we've burned the dinner. It's got a lovely sort of traditional weight to it. The stakes are really good and high. It feels nice in 70s and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you're Irish, it feels like the young ones. It feels like someone's just put a bomb under everything and it's exploded.
That's so true.
It's two sitcoms
Graham
at once.
Graham said, didn't he, that he wanted the thing to have the insanity of the young ones, the intelligence of Blackadder, and the farce of Fawlty Towers, and that now, if you do that as Graham was quite a young writer at this time, Arthur's a bit older than him, but if you do that, you're setting a fucking high bar for yourselves and boy, did they get there.
Yeah.
Because boy, now it's a thing of they're the example now. Father Ted is now the example of I wanted to have this of this.
You can see people ordering off the peg. If you want to do an audience sitcom that isn't Cozy in My Family, people say, I want it to be a bit Father Teddy, a bit Graham and Arthur-y. And what we're talking about here is something which is totally unique that you couldn't do again because it is set in two times. It's set in... It's a different show if you're Irish.
But also the performers were so magical. So you had Dermot Morgan, who had been up to that point doing a priest character on The Late Late Show.
Father Trendy.
Yeah, they're all mainly stand-ups, and aren't they, the cast?
Yeah, well, he had been doing a comedy character and making it onto TV as Father Trendy. But again, he knew the line to sort of dance around between what would make people feel calm and comfortable, so it wasn't actually against the church, it was this weird priest.
Yeah,
that line. And then I know Ardal had been doing bits of stand-up, Pauline was an actress, but all and Father Frank Kelly is a proper respected actor who was a beautiful actor, very verbose, very he was one of those people who'd go hello. He had that Abbey Theatre in Ireland accent that wasn't quite British but wasn't quite Irish, kind of perfect for explaining things.
You can hear that in Jim Norton, who's Bishop Brennan as well.
Yes, exactly.
These people who have done Beckett and they've done...
Beckett and to the past, Ireland will never be free. You know, that sort of real, no microphones yet because we don't have the budget in the theatres. So we speak to the back. That sort of actors, projection.
James stuff, yeah.
And they probably thought like this was their day playing game. And then it turns out that's the iconic role. And I was saying to Ardal, I remember, like, I'm very good friends with Ardal and I love him now. And the idea of being pals with these people who I don't quite know if I would be doing what I would be doing without Graham and Arthur and probably Deirdre O'Kane and Tommy Tiernan. Like, they're all I saw. Mm. And again, when there's a lot of debate about, oh God, you can't just put people on TV, you know, it's indicative, like you can't just box people in or for quotas or everything. Seeing yourself on TV in any way, in some way represented, just takes off that hat that it couldn't be me, possibly.
The flip side of that is if you only see one person on television again and again and again and again, that sends a message that you can't be on TV.
You can't. But and it to doesn't see matter what that I could be on TV in some way, my voice would be funny.
Yes.
And like say, like 50, I hadn't no idea until I went to university and got into a sketch group that in any way women couldn't be funny, because I was the funniest person in my school. I wrote all the, like, as I said recently, I'm sure some people will write it and go, no, she wasn't. But you don't have the microphone in the podcast, guys, so where are you now? That I couldn't believe that anyone would think such stupidity. I grew up in an all-female environment, all-female family, all-female school. And when I was watching telly, Father Ted was on, Pauline was on, that fallen over, looking stupid, putting tea all over herself. You had your one smacking her face in with the frying pan, all these mad nuns. Deirdre O'Kane was on telly beside Tommy Tiernan. And again, they felt like they were me. And I felt like I was them. And they were my stories and my sentiments. And thanks, Graham.
Obviously, the question you have to ask anyone, especially for someone from Ireland, there was a sense that this could be seen as an Irish people are stupid.
Yeah, sitcom. Like some people have that.
Yeah.
But then I know the only person who's ever said that to me was a second generation Irish person. So they are English with Irish parents. So they lived in England. And grew
up sensitive to those kind of
sensitive
jokes.
And he's in his 40s, so he grew up at a time where to have a semi-Irish accent and Irish parents was a sign that you were in some way a little bit stupid or undereducated, or, you know, growing up in the 70s basically as a kid.
You buy those Irish joke books in
Irish
Smith
joke
and
books,
things.
An Irish person walking into the bar, the IRA doing all the things they're doing, like an anti-Irish sentiment in this sort of world. Like I know I've talked about this with my friend Nish Kumar, who's a British Indian stand-up, and he's my age, and he's like the difference in his generation of being in a very educated British Indian in his 30s rather than being an educated Indian British Indian in his mid to late 40s is a very different sense of pride or ownership. Right. And something like the Kumars, for example, had a huge effect on him. But he wasn't 18 when he saw that, like me. He was 11. So you're at the age where you're like, yeah, there's me. And you don't know all the shit that's about to get thrown at you yet. So you don't know all the ways people are going to talk about
this
your,
is like
or
your thing of saying that can women be funny?
If you get told too bloody right at the right age before all the shit can kick in, that stays with you like an inner steel force. And if you don't, your confidence gets knocked and you're constantly questioning yourself and you don't believe you deserve it or that you should be there. And that's where I'm excited for, like, young girls who are like 5 and 10 now to see what they do when I'm in my 50s and 60s, to see what they'll achieve. So I think in the same way, I don't know many Irish people who believe in that about Father Ted, like me.
That's
Irish
brilliant.
People. I really don't. But I'm interested that he was a second gen person who grew up with a slight scar of Silly Paddy, and that was his mother's father, or being a little bit embarrassed by the Irishness. Whereas now people my age, if they have Irish parents, they're like where I am, the post River Dance generation.
Yeah.
We're not associated with the IRA, we're associated with dancing and making loads of money.
Liam. Oh, Ted, come on in. Will you join me?
What? Me dancer? Oh no, I'm not much of a dancer now.
Oh, come on, Ted. Prayer isn't the only way to praise God, you know. And it keeps you fit as well.
It probably helped as well that even though Father Ted is extremely stupid, it's got something in common with Monty Python in that it's clearly not made by stupid people.
Mm.
Everything about it is precise
and clever. Yeah.
And it all falls...
Silliness made by clever people is brilliant.
It's dangerous.
Cleverness made by silly people is terrible.
Yeah, yeah. That's what's brilliant about it is you get the feeling these people are beautifully wasting their intelligence in a joyously profligate way. They're throwing it away. They've got so much.
They could have been lawyers, but instead they've done this. That's what I always get when I watch Nish Kumar, who's one of my best friends, but also one of my favourite stand-ups. I'm like, you're so clever, you should be in the bar or something like that now. You shouldn't be here.
And it's not, I'm not dressing up as the headmaster and I'm thick.
Mm-hmm.
I'm dressing up as the headmaster and I'm as clever as the headmaster. These people dressing as priests, authority figures, and they're clever and faster than those people. And the writers are clever and faster. They're journalists. I mean, Graham and Arthur were writers. They're wordsmiths. They're incredibly fast and nimble. Mm-hmm.
And the authority is a key thing as well, isn't it? Because you've got, these are priests, you know, they're important characters. And they're being absolute fucking idiots, which is lovely. You
and
know.
Having like children.
You've got Ardlo Hanlon saying that he didn't want to stay up to watch a scary film, and Father Ted saying to him, that wasn't a scary film. And he says, oh, come on, Ted, you know, a Volkswagen with its own mind. Nothing scarier than that. He's watched Herbie and he shat himself.
Volkswagen with a mind of its own. Oh, joy of joys.
Joyous is a thing, actually. Oh. I was going to say, when I was watching some of it back again for this, I thought, okay, look, you just take it for granted that it is so fucking funny. Mm-hmm. But I was trying to pin what the other thing was, and I thought, I think it's the joy of it. I think it's the joyousness. And then watching that documentary, Ardlo Hanlon gives it the exact word. He says, giddiness.
Yeah.
And I went, that's what it is. It's so fucking joyous that your head is spinning. What's so great.
What you're watching
it
is the first episode you watch, and it's just, it's got a great thing, which it borrows from the young ones, which is if you put these three walls up and put the cameras on the fourth wall, these people will just talk to each other. And in the young ones, it's got this sense of these voices are funny, or you get actually lots of shows. The voice of the characters is funny. Mm-hmm. It's not the accent, it's the voice.
Yeah.
And they talk in a funny way to each other. You understand who the characters are straight away. They introduce them brilliantly. They wait for a 5 minutes before Mrs. Doyle comes in, so you've got established who the three guys are. And the next thing you think is, I want to spend time with these people.
Yeah.
I want to listen to them just talk to each other. And because
as a writer also, if you know your character, the audience will know the character.
Yes.
And you also know what will happen is, you know, if you put a giant grizzly bear into the, there'll be three different reactions by the three different characters to the grizzly bear in the sitting room,
and the audience won't be surprised by any of those reactions. They'll be delighted,
and that's the nicest thing as a writer. Like, so earlier on I was saying in my show when I'm trying to write, there's this one character and I don't have anyone in mind for it. I don't have a person and I'm really struggling to write this person because I don't know who it is, and I don't know, like, I could write loads of funny lines for them, but I'd be sort of throwing it around and I don't know what would happen, to use a metaphor, if a grizzly bear came into the room. I don't know how he'd react. I'd know know how the other people would.
Yes.
But I don't know how he would react to the grizzly bear. And I'm really struggling. I'm looking around and meeting people trying to be like, who, what actor
it's
are you,
it's why series
what
2 is always easier
you?
Than series 1.
Yeah.
Once you've cast it, you don't realise that's very
yes,
often.
Yes, and then you start writing for an actor. Brilliant. But when you don't know the person, it's really hard to write. And that's what I mean, like that Graeme maybe is trying to write a female character or whatever, but when at the time maybe, and I'm
you're writing a real
yeah,
person who felt
I can
alive.
Literally text him and ask him, but like he probably knew that idiot, the woman, and when you
well,
know
there's
the
a
idiot
whiff of, there's, yeah, a whiff of, there's a whiff of the mum in her. I mean, I remember watching Mrs. Yeah. Doyle and going, I'm not Irish, but my God, she reminded me of my mum and my nan.
Yeah,
and
yeah, yeah.
It's that fussing and you will have a sandwich. It doesn't matter whether your mum's from the East End or yeah. from, they're yeah. all the same. The thing that we always do when we're doing sitcom characters, and when you, the way you can tell that one of them isn't worked out is the grizzly bear test.
Yeah,
as you said.
Yeah.
The two things we learned, one was you draw a grid of them mm-hmm. and you say, you check that all of them have a reaction to each other. Do they like them? Do they dislike them?
And status as well. So what
who's
happens
above,
if someone comes into the room? How
wants
does that
to
change?
Beat them? Do they like each other? And the other one, which someone told us this technique, is what's the worst thing you could say to this person?
Oh, that's lovely.
And that tells you loads down. About them. Is you go, okay, the worst thing you could say to Ted is that you're not important.
Sorry, I'm actually going to get a notepad here just because I'm really struggling with this character and I'm,
but yeah,
learning Joel.
It'll reveal
what's the first thing? What's the worst?
What's the worst thing you could say to this person? And it's like, there's no more food or
and
you are not important.
What's the other thing you said before that?
Is draw a little grid. If it's three characters, 3x3 and say who likes who doesn't like yeah. who. And just, even if it's just a tick or a cross, they get on or not. And you just double check it. Because very often you'll find if you've got an ensemble of more than three people, mm-hmm. you'll have forgotten one of the relationships. You'll have forgotten, does Father Jack like Mrs. Doyle?
Yeah.
There'll be one you haven't seen coming. And at some point, the grizzly bear will run in and you won't know how they react. And you just
yes.
have to double check this. Because if you're working in an office with people, you subliminally in your brain know these answers because mm-hmm. those are real people. But to turn your made up people, the big problem with writing anything is they've all got your voice to begin with.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Unless you sort of know someone. Can I just show you what I drew? Is that was that your card?
Yeah.
That's very good. Yes, yes.
Great.
I think I've seen that in certain toilets.
my son saw,
I drew a penis, ladies and gentlemen.
My son
but I did
saw
write down
one of those
as well.
A piece of graffiti this week and I said, oh dear, it's a willy. And he went, it's not, it's a nose. And I went,
oh.
I have to have a conversation with you to say that when you see that,
oh.
that is not a nose. And a bit of his world died.
Oh. Wait, now why do so many people draw all those noses all over those bathroom walls? Oh no.
Has everyone got a cold in the toilet? What's going on?
Comes out the top of the nose.
Oh,
it's awful. But yeah, I think that trick is that when you first write everybody, they've all got your voice. It's one of the big giveaways when a stand-up gets their first sitcom.
Yeah.
And one of the things I think the big advantage, you find this whenever you hear people who say worked in the Simpsons writers room or whatever, is that or Cheers, or those big ensemble, yeah. big American things, where there are loads of people. That there'll be someone who wrote Carla. There'll
yeah.
be someone who wrote Cliff, who really liked, who wrote Apu,
that's
who
my
liked
mother,
those characters.
That's my sister, that's
and it
my
meant
friend.
That when yeah. it went around the room and it all had the lead writer's voice, someone would say, actually, I tell you what, Frasier wouldn't say that.
Yeah.
Because they know Frasier. It can often be someone you know, or it can be that you've artificially
created
someone.
You know, there's nothing
someone.
Nicer. You know, when you were saying, like, going for a walk or something like that, that you don't... It'll just fall in. So I'm yeah. sitting there trying to write, and I could write 2 pages of this character, but actually... it's not going to happen that way. I'll be in the pub and someone will come up to me and I'll just get a vibe from them. And I'm
a
like,
phrase.
You're them. A phrase. Or I'm like, I know you and you're the person. Like I had that recently for a girlfriend character in this show. There was just this this lovely Welsh actress I know who's really funny. And she was really drunk at Pride. And she came up to me and she was just like really being just really funny, but also really loving. Like great crap, but also like, you're a queen, actually. You should wake up in the morning and think, how much of a queen am I? Because you're such a queen. And I love queens. I just love people who are queens. And if you don't know you're a queen and someone's not treating you like a queen, then fuck up. Just do you know, honestly. And she just wouldn't let me go. And I'm like, oh no, I get you. That's a lovely thing to say. But I had to go to the loo. But she wouldn't. She's like, no. You're not taking it on. You're not taking how nice what I'm saying to you on. I'm trying to be nice to you. And it's just, it was so aggressively nice. Like, no, I can see. No, don't leave now. Because I know you're getting uncomfortable. You won't take compliment, but I need you right now to take this compliment. And I'm like, oh no, I really love, but I genuinely need a wee now. I now know that character's joke because that's what it
yeah,
is. Like,
feel
you
real.
Want to be around her until like pint 4.
The worst way of working is to sit staring a screen and not looking out the window. And because eventually all you're worrying about is yourself. You end up doing that. What's that? Viz did this once, sort of pastiche of a really bad column, which is 10 things I can see from my desk, which is the worst version of where you've run out of ideas. And you're just someone who won't stand up and look around. And you realise that where you get these ideas from is eavesdropping in cafes, eavesdropping on the bus. Make sure
reading
you're
reading 100 pages of a book about squids.
Yeah, open your brain up. The other one is we found the internet. If you don't use the internet as a distraction to just read about your friends saying six of the same thing over and over again on Facebook, actually use the internet when it used to have the whole world in it.
Yeah.
And we do this. We go on
eavesdrop.
To
eavesdrop.
You can use the internet as a bus because there are people on it talking about stuff.
Yeah.
Go on to
it's
a
very
motorbike
hard
forum.
To cure your addiction to phones when you work in comedy because it is a little essential. Yeah. So Twitter is a good way of throwing out an idea and people replying to you and bantering, especially when you're working on your own and like someone going back and forth. For example, Sharon Horgan recently like tweet, there's this thing that went round of like, what's the most on brand you moment for you as a kid? And this woman tweeted like, I remember one time my mother looked at me and said, don't touch that stovetop, that's hot. And the kid looked her straight in the eye and put her hand straight down on the thing and like looked her in the eyes like, no way, psst, and burned her own hand just to defy her mother. And that was like, she was like, that's so a core person of me. And Sharon then tweeted like she had something similar. And then I tweeted like, I remember one time I brought in a puppet to school and I refused to speak through anything but my aunt had brought back this puppet from America and I refused to do anything but speak, and I was about seven, to speak through the puppet the whole time in school, and the puppet would answer the maths questions, and the puppet was actually a hard worker, so she didn't have a bad heart, but obviously it was tough for the teacher. But the teacher did love me and knew I wasn't trying to create malice, but it really distracted everyone in the class, obviously, because Jenny was talking all the time, but Jenny said I didn't her homework, so Jenny wasn't a bad girl. And then at some point the teacher had to say, can Jenny only come in on Fridays because Jenny is so clever, Jenny doesn't need to come in every day. And then Jenny didn't come back.
That's brilliant.
But yeah, and it was so it was like me wanting to make people laugh but being annoying, but the person could see my heart was in the right place. It sparks ideas in little moments, but then how do you get off your phone? Because when you're distracted and you're getting your dopamine hit from a phone, you're like, is this work? Maybe I'll come across a little unicorn, but actually it's just 3 hours of looking at ethical outfits.
It's too distracting because very often as well, one of the things you forget is that when the internet first came out, it had all the world on it. The big exciting was, I could go look at see what's going on in Israel or whatever.
Yeah.
And actually what everyone's ended up doing is just looking at the little village.
Yes.
And you know the 100 people in your village quite well. They're very rarely going to surprise you with a new character note. You're better off going on to the Wolverhampton Wanderers fan forum and typing in washing machine and finding out how Wolves fans deal with their washing machine problems.
How they review them.
You'll hear a new voice there. Mm-hmm. And I think what you're looking for is a voice that feels real because people can tell when characters haven't come from a real place, they feel fake. And the amazing thing about Ted, I think, as an example of that, is that these are four cartoon characters surrounded by other cartoon characters and none of them feel fake.
Yeah.
They feel like people they knew.
And I think that's why Irish people loved them, because they were like, I know that priest. Or I know that nun or that sort of guy. Or even like when it was...
they're exaggerated.
You know, the bad priest next door. He was a teenage guy who was like trying to distract you. For the demo.
Dougal, aren't you going to introduce me to your friend?
Oh, this is Father Demo.
Hello, Father. Playing the old computer game there?
Hello, Father Ted Crilly speaking.
Yes, yes, I'll tell him.
Father Damien, Father Frost says you're to go home. Your tea is ready.
Well, time to feck off then.
He's happy enough here for the moment, Father.
And you just know exactly what that bold or like that naughty boy in the class. Really,
they're like Mr. Men. They're all like they've got little
characters.
My favourite one, which I quote all the time, which is I've had my fun.
And I drove it into a big wall. If you don't like it, tough.
I had my fun, and that's all that matters.
I went out with someone like that as well. I've had my fun, and that's all that matters. But honestly,
what you've got there is almost archetypes, almost like tarot cards. They're representatives of archetypes of bad things about humans.
Character
traits.
They're
all really, really real. And I think that what people forget when they write one of these things, they go, "I'll write a Graham and R3 sitcom. It won't be about a family living in Leeds. It'll be a big cartoon thing about some people who run a lighthouse."
Yeah.
And they forget that no, everyone in this is really real. There's not a moment where Ted isn't completely Ted, where Dougal isn't completely Dougal. There's a great thing. You watch outtakes and Ard Lohanian won't break character, because if he stops being Dougal for a second, and also he can't go back to that place. He's got to be in that beautiful, naive, innocent blankness. Dermot is being a stand-up. He was sitting in the green room and he could never hear the warm-up guy covering for Fluffs, because Dermot would turn to a stand-up persona, keep the audience entertained.
Yeah.
But Ardle is sitting there quietly and still, because he's in character like De Niro. He's deeply... Dougal's real.
Yeah. I think that's what I loved about Father Ted. I look back and, like I was saying, that not just an idiot, but there's a meanness and a bad quality to all of them. Like even Dougal, it's some bad qualities. And I love that moment where I wasn't allowed be ripped the piss out of on the panel show. All of the women have bad quality. They're allowed be knobheads. They're allowed be people vain. You dislike and vain. And I think often sometimes people are afraid to make women knobheads. Like they don't have to be nice people. Yeah.
You look in their eyes and you go, I know what that person wants.
Yeah.
And if that person doesn't want anything, which is how a lot of female characters are written.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want anything. They just want the boy to stop.
Yeah, or for things to be nice again. Guys, could we all just not make the situation nice again? Fuck, you don't want the situation to be nice again. Sometimes you want it to be bad so you get attention or like for everyone to look at you or for him to feel punished for the way he's behaved.
You're losing a joke.
Or that you're losing all these potential jokes, you know, because Mrs. Doyle doesn't technically want everyone to feel nice. She wants to feel in control.
When she destroys that tea everything. Making machine, that thing where she goes in the middle of the night, it's like Mission Impossible to destroy the thing
machine.
That would you realise that it gives
her
reason.
Her, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a brilliant moment, and it's the worst film poster of all time, because I never saw the film. Was a film called Grown Ups, and the film poster was a bunch of men going down a water flume in hoops, and their four girlfriends with their arms crossed, rolling their eyes.
That's
literally hell. That's the worst writing room that's ever happened.
And also in those situations, like, oh God, I get to be, because I audition for them all the time, especially in America. And I'm like, oh, but I'd get to be in a big movie and then maybe that would allow you. But you're like, let me change it for you. Honestly, if you don't worry. If I come in and make a joke, it's not going to take away the joke from someone else. There's like this idea that there's a limited amount of space. Like people have
game.
With like immigration, that there's a limited amount of space or services for people where there isn't actually, because the more people who come in, the more tax that gets paid, you make more and everyone, there's enough for everyone. But there's this idea that there's a limited amount of space for funny. It's like when men think they have to go out with someone who's not funny. As if like, but if she's funny, what'll I do? You're like, you'll both laugh. You will both have a laugh. Everyone will get a laugh. There is not a limited amount of space in the scene. It's not water. It's not oil. It's not going to run out.
It's a
air.
Finite laughing
it's,
resource.
There isn't
it's
a finite
Mrs.
laughing
Doyle
resource.
And her tea machine. It's not.
Yeah, exactly.
Not,
that doesn't take
Mrs.
away
Doyle.
Space from her. Dermot gets to have a reaction to the tea machine, which will be funny. Everyone gets to do something. That's
is
the
that
biggest.
Sure
if there's any comedy writers, old or young, listening in. God damn it, stop making like, oh guys,
you don't need to make
guys.
Space for the jokes.
Yeah, you don't. They're... Women are not there to make space for laughter for men's lines.
I read a bit of one of them once. God, I couldn't finish it. The language, unbelievable. Feck this and feck that.
Yes, Mrs. Doyle.
You big bastard. Oh, dreadful language. You big hairy arse. You big fecker. Fierce stuff. Oh, I don't know why they have to use language like that. I stick this effing pitchfork up your hole. Oh, that was another one. Oh, yes.
I see what you mean, Mrs. Doyle.
Bastard this and bastard that. You can't move for the bastards in her novels. It's one to all bastards.
Is it, Mrs.
You
Doyle?
Bastard,
anyway.
You fecker, you bollocks. Get your bollocks out of my face. I'm just
yes, you just go and prepare for the nuns.
Ride me sideways is another one.
You've got a character here who has no dialogue almost. And
yeah.
even he,
yeah, yeah.
Man, which is a classic rookie writer's mistake. We've all done this. We really find if one of them was silent.
Oh, my God.
You better make
yeah.
sure that guy's a really good clown.
Yeah.
And you better write
you better mime shit in the background.
And
yeah.
weirdly, at the beginning, I think, what, first two episodes
giving
of Ted,
a line see, to a lady see. Like, guys is a version of silence.
Yes.
You may as well mm-hmm. be making them silent.
Spot on.
And
spot
not
on.
Being saying anything.
Well, you've got Father Jack in the middle of it, who is he's almost a prop. At
yeah.
the beginning. But I think in the first couple of episodes, you learn about his backstory.
Yes, there is an example
flashbacks.
Of silence done perfectly.
Yep.
Because he's very loud. And the joke is, for someone who's silent all the time, he's so loud. And makeup and hair and costume, it's the loudest silence you've ever seen. And then like,
he's dominant.
Know.
The whole house
yes,
revolves
exactly
around,
right
him.
Around him. So there's a loudness to his silence
yeah.
that's on purpose.
And he's treated like a brilliant flourish, isn't he? Because
yeah.
a lot of what he says is just feck or arse mm-hmm. or girls or whatever. But every now and then he does something like, how did that gobshite get on television?
Yeah, yeah,
or he
yeah,
does that
yeah,
amazing
yeah.
thing in the last
yeah,
episode where they crossfade to him and he's singing, I'll be seeing you in apple blossom time. Whoa! You've given
yeah.
him all the guitar solos.
Yeah.
It's brilliant.
And again, the darkness of it as well, which I think is, Ireland has very rarely produced successful sitcoms. And the big thing is that most of us go to England where we're free to make jokes about ourselves that then sell back home. So if you look at even like Sharon and Catastrophe,
yeah.
there's no, like even Brendan O'Carroll. Brendan, whatever your view is on Mrs. Burns Boys, that is a well-honed character.
Yes.
He's been doing that since I was a kid.
Yeah.
And he
yeah.
plays to stadiums. And that is a form of comedy that is a craft. And it's really well-crafted, whether you like it or not. Mm. And he, again, that was kind of commissioned by the BBC over here. Brendan has been doing that character for probably all my lifetime. So 15
yeah.
years. and he has been doing that. And it's so well crafted. But again, England took it on and made it. And so there's something about coming over here and allowing us to make a sitcom. And the danger on darkness of Father Ted, like Jack is an alcoholic.
Yes.
He
yeah.
has a deeply, and he's still getting paid for by the state to be a head of a religious order.
And in the flashback you see of him, he's at a girls' school asking them to take their netball tops off.
Yeah. Yeah, he is a dark
is
character.
And unpleasant.
And it's supposed to be creepy. He's not being foot like that.
No,
that
not,
still
it's not
stands
a
test
joke.
Of time. Now you're not looking back at it going, oh, that was okay.
No.
It's not.
It's
still
meant to be
meant
creepy.
To be
back
creepy.
Then.
He's a bad priest.
Yeah. Look at him. Dreaming of past glories, no doubt.
Girls, pay attention. We've got a special treat today. Father Hackett has very kindly volunteered to take an all for volleyball practice. Oh, right, Father. And he's just reminded me that it's very warm today, so there'll be no need for your tracksuit tops.
And even the idea of Ted with his gambling addiction or the stuff in Ireland about marriage or murder. There's
but the
murder,
sit, the cities, of, these
yeah.
are disgraced priests.
Yeah, disgraced.
I mean, Ronald Graham saying that in the height of the Catholic church scandal.
Yeah.
He said, I think I'd have trouble making
right,
light
now.
Of this
yeah,
now.
Yeah,
because
of the anger and sadness.
But
yeah.
I think the anger and sadness is in it all the way through. I think there's
it's
no
like
question.
We all knew, but we didn't know how bad. It was that sort of
yeah.
thing. So he made it just, I think it was all the stars lining up, even the timing of when he make it. Because I also think that something like Father Ted and how popular it was in Ireland was, in the same way comedy can do this, piercing the first little prick
yeah.
in the balloon, and this is how beautiful comedy is and it can do this, that they're everything, that they cannot be knocked off a pedestal.
Yes.
There's some things you can't joke about and one of them is a church. No, you can. And once you see them as fallible and once you see them as people and silliness, the silliness, and you're going, God, what are we, why are we bowing down to this? Then all of a sudden you think, oh, we don't have to. Maybe I don't have to do all these things. It's that same
yeah.
it's that same thing. And I think Father Ted, culturally in Ireland, had a huge effect on being part of the movement. I remember making an abortion joke in Ireland 3 years ago that killed in England when I did it. And when I went home, people were like, oh. And I started doing it recently,
really?
Just before the referendum, and it was a totally different reaction. I'm like,
wow.
only 3 years.
Wow.
So
up.
I really
wow.
brought about it around. I brought about the results
yeah.
with my joke.
Well
no, I'm joking.
Congratulations.
But the difference that you pierce through with once subjects come through in comedy, in that you give a little punch and then all of a sudden everything falls apart and people can start seeing where the truth is almost. And I think Father Ted was a big part of that. No one was doing anything like it.
The dangerous thing, I suppose, if you've set yourselves up as more than human, is do something as warm as Father Ted, which humanizes people and set themselves up to be more than human. I was joking once saying that one of the things that all religions have got in common, the reason you can tell they're patriarchies, is the first thing you do in most religions is do something to the top of your head where there's male pattern baldness. You either put a hat on there or shave it off. Because at some point, someone who said, hello, I'm the most important person in your village, bent over and over went, ha ha, you've got a bald head. Well, what we'll do is we'll insist everyone wears hats. The women should cover their heads as well. Why? Because otherwise, so God wants it.
I'll get a boner from their hair, so put it on, cover it up.
Make sure everything's covered up. Why? Is it because you lose your hair? No, it's fine. And once you realise these people are human and vain and fallible, weirdly, it makes them nicer and more lovable and you love them, but also it makes it harder for them to go, I have authority, that means I'm not subject to the same human laws as you.
Infallible.
While we're on vulnerability, can I ruin the atmosphere?
Oh, please, Jason, you've been doing it since I've known you, so why change it, a lifetime?
Can we talk about Dermot Morgan? Because this really fucking upset me today when I was just looking back at the old Father Ted clips. He was 45 when he died.
Yeah.
I'm older than he ever lived to be, and that really got to me.
Like, knowing now Pauline and knowing Ardal and knowing Graham, like, my heroes from growing up, like, truly influential people on me, my performing, my career, everything. I would have loved to have met Victoria Wood and Dermot Morgan. God, yes. Are two people I would really have loved to have met. Yeah. Yeah, I know their kids, I think, are maybe in their 20s now. They're very proud of him and talk a lot about him and stuff that's...
I read this one of the story which I didn't know, which is Declan Lowney, who directed it.
Yes.
Who brilliantly directed the 1988 Eurovision Song Contest.
Oh, really?
And also did My Lovely
Declan.
Horse.
Wow.
But Declan Lowney, who directed this, he's a grown man now. He's called Ted.
Oh, really?
Because his wife was pregnant. They found out the day after... The day after Dermot Morgan died. So he named it. And you go, that is someone who's made an impression on people who work with, to the extent they want him to want to mark him. He's clearly a man who was so loved. I mean, not just by viewers, but by everyone who worked with him.
When everything's going okay, I keep imagining all the terrible things that can happen. And now that one of those things has actually happened, it's just a rush. I feel fearless, like Jeff Bridges in that movie.
I haven't seen that one.
Not many people have, Dougal. It's probably a bad reference. Anyway. Let's go.
Obviously, we've said the three things that Graham says it was meant to echo, which is Blackadder, The Young Ones, and 40 Towers, high bars in sitcom. Mm-hmm. The other thing it reminds me of, because it does lots of cutaways, is The Simpsons. It's a cartoon.
Yes.
They will spend the money on props and stunts for Ted to go through a window, for Mrs. Doyle to fall off things. They've got these things because mainly it's three walls and people just talking, which is quite cheap. You can then say, we're going to have Dougal's funeral and the hearse is going to explode, or there'll be a helicopter shot. They can spend money on those things. So you can do cutaways like The Simpsons. It's got a cartoonish thing. So you've got these guys in the middle of it who are cartoon characters, which is why I think, again, you can say quite savage, weird things because they don't feel quite real. They're heightened. Yeah. But at the same time, everyone in it's so full of heart and so warm that they are real characters. And Geoffrey Perkins said this, that it would be loved. And it was when Neil Hannon wrote the music for it. Mm-hmm. And he submitted two pieces of music, one of which was a whistly song that he'd eventually used on Casanova to be Woman of the World. And Graham and Arthur said, we'll use that one because it sounds like a ding-dong, ding-dong, Terry and June. This is a sitcom. We're going to take the piss. A bit student prank. A sketch, like a Henry Moore kind of Toby Davis sketch. And Geoffrey Perkins said, no, use the other one, the romantic sweeping one.
Yeah.
He said, because people are going to love these characters.
Sweep us in.
Sweep us in across that shot. And apparently, I spoke to Darren Allison, who's a friend who produced the music. And I said, tell us stories of this. And he said, oh, they sent us some silent video of that opening shot.
Mm-hmm.
And we wrote the music over it. And he said, the great thing is, it was recorded in the Jesus and Mary Chains studio on the Jesus and Mary Chains guitars, which is the most unlikely thing, because that's the studio that Darren could get. And they put this thing together and made the sweeping piece of music, which is full of heart and full of love and romance and just draws you in and makes it warm. They did that. And he said, it took about 5 hours to put down that theme music. And it took about 20 times as long to make My Lovely Horse. love the idea that the bad song took so much longer.
It's hard. I remember watching an interview with Uma Thurman about trying to bad dance in Pulp Fiction. And she's like, it's really hard to do bad dancing. And what they had to do was think of a song, say if the end song was going to be, say, 4/4 in terms of beats, they had to dance in their minds to a song that was 3/4.
So they would be in there,
so they would be out of sync with what was happening.
Actually, but the warmth of the Sig tune as well and the characters is brilliant. I mean, God, Geoffrey Perkins made so many good decisions on this thing. Ditto Declan Lowney. Mm-hmm. But the warmth of all that stuff is needed because when you look at the programme, all the exterior stuff, they're fucking freezing, aren't they?
Wet.
It's so cold and wet and awful out there. It's quite deliberately, they shot the exteriors in November so they would just be as hostile as possible. And the house looks terrible,
When they're with Michael Redmond as Father Stone playing crazy golf on that windmill that falls over, and they've obviously they've trained hoses on them to make them as possible. You don't need to do that in Ireland, sure.
There's the bit where they get...
Craggy. Everything about it feels craggy.
Perfect name, isn't it? Yeah. Craggy Island.
Craggy Island, it just feels so craggy.
Well, the opening episode where they've got the fairs arrived, and it's basically Dougal wants to go to the fair, and the main attraction is a crane with a park bench.
But it's also not that. I remember going to St. Patrick's Day parade in a small town in Leash where my granddad was from, and one of the displays coming through was an army tank with children sat on top of it. And we were asked if he wanted to go and sit. And some of my cousins were sitting on it. And then someone else in a Jeep driving down a place they would have been driving anyways. And we were like, yeah, happy St. Patrick's Day. Woo! No, this is a parade. This is not just a traffic jam. This is actually a parade. It looks like a traffic jam. But the difference is we're telling you it's a parade. Producer and the director and the writer, so Graham and Arthur and Declan and everyone, and Guy, everyone who's come together in the cast. These things are like when a great band comes together, because everyone's on the same page and playing from the same sheet, and everyone's doing the same thing. There's nothing worse. I remember doing a movie in Ireland before, and the writer of the script was a very quick, smart person and wrote a great script, and the director was a really great director but loved soft indie movies, and he was in charge of this quick-witted script. And we were all kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place, and that two different things were happening at the same time. And so he loved soft shots and made it very romantic, but then and changed a lot of the lines. So like, let's improv around the scene. But a lot of the basis of the movie was snap, snap, snap.
Yeah.
And it was hard because I'm like, oh, I see both of you. Yeah. But you're a really good drummer for a different band.
Yeah.
And on this, everyone's there. It's the right chemistry for the band has come together.
You read it in reviews a lot, and people will go, I've worked out what's wrong with this. It's a terrible script. And you go, God, in the hands of another director, different actor, this script would have flown. And audience is reading the screen constantly. They're going, am I in safe hands? Does this cast look like they think it's funny? Does everyone have faith in the project? Mm-hmm. Is everyone in the same rhythm? Is the band good? And one person getting it wrong, you watch it and you don't understand where you're meant to be laughing.
I remember thinking that it is honestly like it chemistry. If you boil it down, it's why people like watching First Dates, the TV show First Dates.
Yeah.
I remember I love that show. And I remember watching, it's a great show. I remember on one of the episodes, they put this guy in and he was like, he had this like Spanish sort of accent, and he came in and he was like, oh my God, I love beautiful black girls. That's my thing that I love. And he met this girl who was just a really serious PE teacher. And the more and more she didn't react to him, the crazier he seemed. So like, no, honestly, your figure, your beautiful figure. Oh my God. And she go, oh, I found that very offensive. And he's like, oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to, you know, yeah, he's crazy. I don't like him. He did seem, you're like, oh my God, he's been put in as a sort of
stunt
casting. I'm like, oh God. And then 2 weeks later, he's back in the First Dates restaurant and he comes in and there's this other girl there and she fits the same physique and she's a voluptuous black woman. And he's like, oh my God, I love your figure. You're beautiful. And she just went, and she just laughed. And suddenly he was funny because she got him.
Yeah.
But he didn't seem bad in comparison, yes, when he was with the right person. Even if you need, in a relationship, you have to find someone who finds your madness lovely. Someone, yeah, else might find it disgusting. But to that person, like, even Quasimodo deserves to be with someone who's like, do you know what? You are such a good bell ringer. And that is like my main thing about you. I cannot see past how good at bells you are ringing. He's like, thank you. But rather than being like, oh, you're back.
And weirdly, when you're talking about the chemistry in a date and the chemistry within a sitcom team or a TV team, if everyone in the room likes each other, mm, and everyone's getting on and you can see it when you're watching, weirdly, they're all character witnesses for each other. And yes, you get the feeling, you're going, oh, probably this is, it's like eavesdropping on a conversation around a pub where everyone's laughing.
Yeah.
If you sit down and think they're all dicks, you won't laugh along with them. But if they all appear to be enjoying each other's company, you might sit near them and listen in, and
yeah,
and they're all vouching for each other that this is funny.
Yes.
And yeah, with something as delicate as whimsy, which is what Father Ted's got, sort of Flann O'Brien-y whimsy to it, whimsy needs the confidence that Bob Mortimer's face gives Vic Reeves's performance.
Yeah.
He believes this guy's funny. So maybe him.
I was talking to the producer recently of Vic and Bob, and she was like, most of me generally is going, yes, okay, Bob, we can get an apple that looks like a horse. Two of the guys together, like Jim and Vic, like Bob, they just have each other's backs so much. Yeah. I've never seen anything like it. And again, that sort of magic of meeting your soulmate in some way, I kind of think it about the two of you as well. If you meet that person that you're like, oh, we could do things separately, but imagine we found each other. It is like a life wife in many ways. It's such a magical thing to come across if you can find your work or the person who gets that. I have a version of that with my friend Brona C. Titley, who's a comedy writer. And she, like when I was doing my Netflix special, she came out to Atlanta with me. And even though we don't often always write together, she was on 8 out of 10 Cats with me as my head writer. She's an amazing comedy writer, actress, performer.
Yeah.
But just we get each other. If there's something wrong in my bit, she'll go, I see where you are and you're still coming across as a star, don't get me wrong, but let's just change this bit. Yeah. It's a lot of chance. It's a lot of magic and chance, and it's the thing that rom-coms are sort of made of, but it's a lovely
luck
thing when
is
it happens.
The thing you can't manifest. But
you two guys meeting when you did so young and just having the same, like, yeah, you're like me, I like that too, and being able to work with each other on as many things
as
you do.
I was shocked to hear Graham and Arthur talk. There's a very nice, you can still listen to them, they're all on the iPlayer, a thing called Chain Reaction that was on Radio 4.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's a really nice one where Adam Buxton and Graham Linehan interview each other. And they talk, those are two people I think of as having a comedy wife, as in Adam Buxton with Joe Cornish, yeah, and Graham
with Arthur.
With Arthur during those formative years. And they both talk about how prickly those relationships are, and that Graham outgrew his relationship with Arthur frighteningly quickly, and possibly too quickly, because they work so well together. It's a shame.
Well, there's working on a project together really well,
yeah,
and then there's something like, oh, life is easier with you in my life.
Yes.
It's very different. So not just working on a project together.
Yes,
two actors
totally
can have amazing chemistry because of the characters that have been written. That doesn't mean they should be in everything together.
Yes, very
so,
true.
Yeah. So that's very different. Like Graham and Arthur made Father Ted amazing, and that's a project that they needed each other for,
yeah,
but then they didn't need each other going through.
Or that's the phrase Graham used. Graham said, I suddenly realised I didn't need him anymore.
Or it wasn't easier. Yeah, exactly. It didn't make the workplace lovelier, whereas I will always have Brona in my life and Brona will always have me. Whether at some point we write a show together, that would be, I often think with Brona, if I have a show with her, we'd probably both die happy if it went successfully, because I'm like, oh God, imagine if we just had this. That wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. If you two guys had just a show together where you just came into the office and wrote it, which is kind of your life in many ways, it wouldn't be the worst way to spend a life.
No.
Like, that would be a version of success, because your soul is full as well. But just because you have one good project together, that's not the test.
Yes.
It's the test is over the years and the decades. You come back to each other because you know this, it's right and it's easier.
But one of the things that you find when you're working in collaboration with anybody is you look at them and go, well, if they're still here,
yeah,
then I can't be that bad.
Yes, exactly.
Because you can leave at any point.
And yeah,
at
one
point,
and but that, you don't want is, to. Maybe I'm not awful.
Yeah, because very often you think you are awful, especially if you're not doing the work's shit and you're not producing stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's someone to just put pressure on you to go, come on, finish.
Yeah.
Come on, because I'm finishing. And there's a little bit of competition. But what you want is support rather than competition. And the thing that you can see in good projects like Father Ted is that everyone's working to support each other. Everyone's got each other's backs. And you're a team.
Think those things are like the chemistry of a band, and that's why a lot of bands fall apart, because eventually they want different things.
Then
there's a difference of like a relationship,
a long term,
which I
one.
Think a long term relationship, like what it's again different. What I say you guys have and I have with my friend Brona, is that is That's not like a sitcom coming together. That's more like a marriage.
Yeah.
And that is beyond friendship. I do, like, we like bro. Sometimes people are like, "Oh, you're friends with Brona." And I'm like, that's insulting.
Yeah.
She's my soulmate. And like, I genuinely, I was like, I don't know how to describe to you that she's my soulmate. Like, in her wedding speech to her wife, she had to reference me. Yeah. I was like, it could have been me. What a bloody loving.
Hey, what the hell?
Brilliant.
What the hell?
Ashing B, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.